Trendstorm.
Welcome back to Trendstorm. Now let's take a look at India and Pakistan's 70th anniversary of independence. It's been 7 decades since the British Raj was epically split apart, and after many twists and turns in their relationship since then, it's fitting to reflect on what the future holds in store for both India and Pakistan. These two states might be neighbors, but their relations have been anything but neighborly over the years. They've fought 3 wars against one another and still remain at tense odds to this day over the future of the former princely state of Kashmir. The long-standing distrust between India and Pakistan is globally relevant because of the over 1 billion people that collectively live in these two nuclear-armed states, meaning that any hot war between them runs the very dangerous risk of suddenly escalating into a nuclear exchange of unthinkable devastation for humanity. Interestingly, 70 years after independence, India and Pakistan appear to be on the cusp of a grand strategic reversal in many respects. Whereas Pakistan was once conceived of for a period of time as being a strictly religious state, India under the ruling RSS-aligned BJP of Prime Minister Modi is more visibly embracing the ideology of Hindu nationalism, also known as Hindutva. Moreover, while Pakistan was in the Western camp during the old Cold War and India was in the Eastern one, that too appears to be changing in the new Cold War. Pakistan experienced a falling out of sorts with the U.S. in recent years and is in the midst of a rapid rapprochement with Russia. While India has diversified its long-standing relations with Russia in favor of a so-called multi-alignment policy, which has seen it become the U.S.'s major defense partner. In addition, after separating from the British Raj, India and Pakistan now have to contend with their own separatist movements inside of their borders. Pakistan lost what was formerly known as East Pakistan to the Indian-backed Mukti Bahini that founded what is current-day Bangladesh, and is still fighting off and on against various groups in Balochistan. India, for its part, has been confronted by numerous separatist groups in its northeastern states, colloquially called the Seven Sisters, since almost the moment after its independence, and this remains an enduring challenge for the country to this day. These religious, geostrategic, and separatist factors will come together to determine the future of South Asia, so it's appropriate on the 70th anniversary of India and Pakistan's independence to discuss their present-day importance. All right, folks, so we're going to dive into this topic. I know it's very deep, but I'm sure that our experts are going to provide a lot of important insight into it for us. The first one that we're speaking to is Mr. Bill Purkayastha. He is an Indian cartoonist, author, and former columnist with Subversify magazine.
Trendstorm.
Okay, Bill, how has the role of religion changed in India since its independence, bearing in mind the concerns that many have expressed lately that the ruling BJP is flouting the state's constitutional secularism through its embrace of Hindu nationalism? And also, Bill, what effect do you think this will have on society in the coming years?
Okay, there are two different things here. The first thing is that this is not Hinduism as it has always been. Historically, Hinduism is never an institutional religion. It has always been an extremely diverse religion, more like an amalgam of several different faiths which only are loosely allied than a single religion. So the first thing is that Hinduism as it was can never be used as a political tool, as it was, because you cannot put together different strains of Hinduism which have nothing in common, either culturally or religiously, into one straitjacket. However, that is the first thing that our current government is doing. The effort is to turn Hinduism into a close clone of something akin to Wahhabism. In my opinion, Hinduism has been in line of being turned into an Abrahamic faith, very much like the more extreme variations of Islam and Christianity and Judaism, with intolerance as its primary purpose. This is not, absolutely not, the past history of Hinduism.
Okay, this is very interesting, Bill, but I just real quickly want to move on to the international perspective of things, because I think that we can definitely have our own show all about this, and it is absolutely fascinating for me. I'm learning a lot, but I want to draw some attention to the U.S.'s closer relationship with the U.S. over the past couple of years. I mean, we see that it signed the Lamoa deal, and it's formally become the U.S.'s major defense partner. So how do you see this unprecedented development playing out in the future, especially considering the present Indian-Chinese tensions and their overall great power rivalry?
The first thing is that this is not unprecedented. Before 1963 to 64, India had a fairly close defense relationship with the West. At the time of the 1962 war against China, the Jawaharlal Nehru government had actually appealed to the Americans for military aid. Only after the British and the Americans refused to supply India with more modern weapons like submarines, did India finally turn to the Soviet Union for military aid. During the Korean War, India had actually sent hospital teams to aid the so-called UN forces, which were basically what is today NATO in Korea. Now, this is just a return to the time when India used to depend on the West for military aid. However, things have changed. Two things. First, China has now become much more powerful than it was before, while at the same time, America is declining as a power. So even if India thinks that America is going to support India against China, it is not going to be possible in the long run because the USA is not going to commit suicide in order to help India fight China. Just over this past Doklam face-off against China, America has stayed rather silent. This is not something that India will have failed to notice. Also, as the previous question of yours, Hindu bigotry, as it finishes with the Muslims, it will inevitably turn anti-Christian. And that is going to run very foul of the strong Christian constituency in the US. So I do not see that this has got a very long-term significance because there's inevitably going to be a downturn of India-US relations over the long term as India turns into an overtly fascist country.
Okay, I see. Well, the last thing I want to ask you then in our discussion today, Bill, is why do the decades-long separatist insurgencies in the Seven Sisters continue to linger to this day, 70 years after independence, and how optimistic are you that they'll be resolved soon, taking into account the prioritization that India is giving to its Act East policy of ASEAN integration and the related trilateral highway that's supposed to run through the region?
Well, the first thing is that the lack of development is the cause of the original insurgency. People can keep on telling, tales about how India forcibly incorporated these areas into the country, but that does not force ordinary teenagers into militant groups. So, but development by itself is not a solution. Here in the northeast of India, it's a very tribal society. Tribal identities are extremely important to this day, and tribal identities are basically parochial and racist. They are extremely suspicious of so-called outsiders, and you cannot possibly have development without people from outside coming in and people from here moving out. So development, while it would bring benefits, has also run up against the tribal cultures of the region. At the same time, Delhi has been singularly inept in its treatment of the northeast of India. For example, the northeast of India is actually much closer to Hanoi and Southeast Asia than it is to Delhi, literally, geographically. However, we have been forced to compete against the rest of India economically and away from the natural trading area of Southeast Asia. So this has, and this being a very badly landlocked area with almost no connection to the rest of the country, has always seen higher prices, lesser development, lesser supply of goods and services, and is pretty much a forgotten backwater. As such, unless the situation of the central government and its attitude towards the Northeast changes, I don't see any further great developmental or other changes of attitude here. At the same time, the insurgencies can be crushed militarily. There's no doubt about that. But crushing an insurgency and ensuring the long-term dissolution of the circumstances that raised the insurgency in the first place are a different matter.
Bill, thanks a lot for shedding insight into this. I thought it was very interesting, and I hope our audience also learned a lot. Some of this was new for me as well. Thanks a lot. Now we're going to switch over and get the Pakistani side of things by speaking to Ms. Sabina Siddiqui. She is a foreign affairs journalist and lawyer from Pakistan.
Trendstorm.
Okay, Sabina, Pakistan officially became an Islamic Republic in 1956 and then went through what some have described as an intense period of Islamization during the 1980s. But what's the role of Islam in Pakistan today, and how's the situation of the minority religions, and how does all of this compare to other Muslim-majority countries?
Well, Pakistan has been an Islamic state even before 1956, because the founder of Pakistan, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, he always spoke about Pakistan as an Islamic state in all his speeches, even as far back as 1938. Well, and General Ziaul Haq, when he took over, he did try to establish like a more rigid type of Islamic ideology in Pakistan. But in my opinion, it was not anywhere close to the kind of Islamic system enforced in countries like Iran or Saudi Arabia. Basically, the major steps he took were like establishing a Council of Islamic Ideology and a Sharia court, which ran in parallel with the formal legal system of the country. And this was for the purpose for Islamic topics to be discussed, and religious matters were referred to these two established organizations. Otherwise, today, like after like so many decades now, Pakistan is a moderate Muslim state. No special change really occurred due to these religious steps that were taken by General Zia. Hardline factions are not in the political mainstream at all. Whenever we have general elections, they hardly manage to win a few seats. And the winning parties, political parties in Pakistan, are usually liberal or moderate.
Sabina, the next thing I want to ask you real quickly, just because this is, you know, and we can go on with this. I know it's a very deep topic, but I just want to get to a couple other issues real quick while I still got you on the line for the segment. And I want to ask you about a broader perspective of things, about Pakistan's changing foreign policy, because we've seen that it's used to be one of the closest U.S. allies in the world, but lately it's regarded as China's top ally, and it's making fast inroads in improving its relationship with Russia. So what caused this presently unfolding geostrategic reorientation, and how far do you think it'll go now?
The U.S. and Pakistan have had close ties since decades, but Pakistan has felt let down many times, especially after the U.S. war on terror in Afghanistan. In that, we lost like 60,000 lives as a U.S. frontline ally, but still we are always asked to do more constantly. So it is time now for Pakistan to think of its national interests, and India has become the major defense partner of the U.S. and it has a nuclear deal, and that is not to go. Pakistan has fought like or several wars with India over Kashmir, so this was a major turning point. And Pakistan went ahead with the Pakistan and China relationship. It enhanced it to a strategic partnership, and the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor development in turn brought about a new political alignment, which is the convergence of economic and security interests of Russia, China, and Pakistan. So, in my opinion, the CPAC has played a decisive role in creating the new bloc. And even Russia started re-evaluating its relations with India after the logistics deal with the U.S. So the three countries have now a common strategy regarding the ISIS threat in Afghanistan. And this new alliance is focused on changing the ground realities there and the Taliban. China, Russia, and Pakistan have a common focus and the same counterterrorism objectives. So it should be a long-term partnership, and I don't think there's any fancy about this new alliance. And Pakistan has even become part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization recently. I see the three countries have a long way to go together.
Okay, well, the last thing I want to ask you then is what's behind the violence in Balochistan? How long do you foresee it continuing, and how serious of a threat does it pose to the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor?
Well, the Balochistan Liberation Movement is actually an Indian-backed proxy war with the aim to slow down the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor and destroy investor confidence by labeling Pakistan as an unsafe destination. India has actually tried the same techniques that it tried before in East Pakistan, which has now become Bangladesh. And it has not achieved the same success in Balochistan, as it is not geographically aligned to it like East Pakistan was. The Pakistan Army has destroyed the terrorist network, and a lot of information was taken from this captured Indian spy Kulbhushan Yadav. So what we have now are random terror attacks by mercenaries sneaking in from hideouts in Afghanistan. So this so-called Balochistan Freedom Movement now exists only on social media. And Baloch leaders like Brahan Das Gupta, etc., living in India. So this was an impediment to stop the CPAC. But the CPAC has luckily proved hard to sabotage. China has made sizable equity investments in the mega project. Approximately more than $30 billion have already been harnessed in the project. And it is predicted that investments could even touch $150 billion in the next 10 years by the time it is completed. So the Chinese are the major stakeholders with a 40-year lease of quarter ports. So it is not really in Pakistan's hands to roll back or stop the project, even if a portion of the corridor is damaged with an attack. I don't think the project can get shelved now. And in my opinion, improved security measures like the Special Security Division, which has been made by the Pakistan Army, it comprises of 15,000 military personnel to protect the CPAC. It can reduce the terror threat as well as exterminate the proxy terror network completely. So I don't think that it's a very serious threat for the CPAC. It should go ahead.
Sabina, thanks a lot. That was very fascinating, and it definitely was very interesting to hear about what Pakistan has been through since independence. Thanks a lot for explaining that to our audience. We appreciate it.
Trendstorm.
Now, folks, if we think back on what our Indian and Pakistani guests both share with us today, I think that we can really come to the conclusion that both countries have come a very long way since independence, but at the same time, they are still changing. And it almost seems as if on this very pivotal anniversary, they're undergoing very fundamental changes in terms of their identities, in terms of their geostrategic alliances, and just also in terms of their general trajectory. So we need to keep our eyes on where this is headed and see whether or not this grand strategic reversal will unfold as far as we may think it will. So folks, if you want to sound off and share what you think about this, please send us an email at radio@sputniknews.com or find us on Facebook. Stay with us.